This episode is sponsored by Factor. Do you struggle to find the time and energy to consistently eat healthy? You're not alone, and there is a solution. Introducing Factor, the all-in-one meal delivery service that preps, cooks, and delivers fresh, never frozen, fully prepared meals directly to your door weekly. With Factor, every meal is designed by dietitians and handcrafted by world-class chefs, keeping your taste buds happy and your waistline trim. What's more, the menu changes every week, so you never lose interest in eating healthy. Right now, Factor is offering listeners of the Reverie True Crime Podcast $50 off their first 2 weeks. Just go to factor75.com. Pick your meals and use the code PODCAST50 at checkout to claim this limited-time offer. That's factor75.com, code PODCAST50. Factor is offering members an extra $20 off for a total of $70 off your first 2 weeks of Factor if you email your receipt to david@podgo.co. That's david@podgo.co. I'm your host, Paige, and you're listening to Reverie True Crime. For this episode, I sat down virtually with Orlando Ori Spado. He will tell us how one man can go from selling insurance to rubbing shoulders with mob bosses, Hollywood's elite, and essentially becoming an accidental gangster. You can find out more juicy stories in his book, The Accidental Gangster. Go to theaccidentalgangster.com, and when you order Ori's book, you'll receive a signed copy. I want to thank Orlando again for his time and sharing a lot of his story with all of us. Please stay tuned until the end of the episode to hear a promo for a great podcast called A Little Bit Grim. Now, let's get into it.
Good morning.
Good morning, Orlando. We're recording.
Hi, Paige.
How are you?
Hang on here. All right, let's get this thing.
How are you this morning?
I'm all right. I was going to promote something on Instagram. I bought a paid promotion, and they rejected it because I got a cigarette.
That's crazy.
I mean, I can't promote my book because I'm lighting a cigarette on my book.
That is insane.
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
All right, well, we'll figure that out.
Yeah. Well, do you want to jump right into it? And let me ask you a hard-hitting question.
Yeah, go ahead.
All right. So, how did Orlando Spado get into the insurance business?
Well, after the Army, I had a job at Revere Copper and Brass. I worked there 3 weeks and 3 days. Then I went to a company called Kelsey Hayes, another factory. I was there a couple months, and I knew I did not want to work in a factory, that was for sure. And I can't remember who the gentleman, I spoke to somebody about insurance, and I ended up with the Prudential Insurance Company. And it came so natural to me, and I enjoyed it. I got to dress up, and I'm good at talking with people. And I became extremely successful and became a member of the Million Dollar Roundtable with a Prudential Insurance Company.
Okay.
And so, I was selling over $1 million a year in insurance.
Whoa. So how do you go from selling insurance to becoming associated with the mob and the crime organization?
Well, you know, I'm a businessman first. And as a businessman, you have to talk to a lot of different people. But a very dear friend of mine, his name was Frank Russo. He was a lawyer. But his father was the boss many, many years ago in upstate New York. My grandfather was with him. They were from Calabria, Italy. And slowly but surely, he was introducing me to all the bosses throughout the country. And I got to know them all. And then I had my first indictment in Syracuse, New York, and I lost my insurance license. And, you know, I'm a guy that wakes up in the morning and I'm always figuring, how am I going to make a dollar?
Yeah.
And I was never a guy to go and take a salary someplace and work someplace. It's just not me. Because, you know, you can't make the kind of money that I want when you're on salary someplace. If I would have stayed in the insurance business and things went right, yeah, I'd probably be up there today making the. But it is, life is what it is. And so I became very well known. And then I became long-standing friends of over 40 years with Sonny Frances, the other boss of the Colombo crime family.
Yeah. Well, do you remember how you met Sonny, and did y'all get along right away, or how was that?
Well, I actually met Sonny. I was also a distributor for a company called Polyglyco. Polyglyco was the first company to come out with a sealant for the automobile. No need to shine your car again, guaranteed for 3 years. And it was sold through automobile dealers. And Walter founded the company. We were big. We were big, but not only in the United States, we were in other countries. And by this time, I was getting divorced, and I was down at my condo in Florida. Walter had a condo in Boca Raton, and he called me up. And Walter was older than me, and always called me Kid. Hey, Kid, you know, I'm getting these death threats. I said, Walter, nobody's going to call you up and threaten you. I said, somebody's going to kill you. They're just going to kill you. I said, and I said, stop worrying about it. So then he called me up and asked me to fly into New York City because we had an appointment with the largest Cadillac dealer, Victor Potomkin. And he wanted me to help close the deal for the Polyglyco product. So I flew in, and we closed the deal, and then we all got in Victor's limousine, and we went to Club 21 in New York for lunch. Talking about in the days, no cell phones, you know. Walter went to use the payphone to call his office. He comes back. He's white as a ghost. He leans over. He says, Kit, I know you're wired in. He says, this is serious. You got to find out who it is. He said, will you stay over? I said, okay. So I called Frank Russo. Frank Russo said, Frank Russo was in upstate New York. So he says, call Lou Perry. Lou Perry was a casting director, and he happens to be the guy that discovered D. Martin Jerry Lewis.
Okay.
So I called Lou, and Lou calls me back, and he says, I'll pick you up at your hotel at 7. He picked me up. We went to a restaurant on 2nd Avenue in New York called Trattoria Siciliana. And this is where I met Sonny Frances. And I'm always an observant guy at a young age for some reason. I mean, the moment I walked in the restaurant, I was able to detect. I mean, I knew I was meeting a big gangster. I didn't know who.
Okay? Yeah. Yeah.
And I I could tell where the FBI were, where other guys were. Turned out the restaurant was owned by Sonny's son-in-law, Eugene, who he and I became close friends later. But Sonny and I, we had a conversation. We whispering to each other. And he and his wife was at the table. His son, Johnny, who became an informant as he got older on our case and against his father. His daughter, Gia, and his daughter, Tina. And Sonny took my numbers and he says, check into it. Because Sonny, offhand, he didn't know nothing about it. And I got violently ill from the fish that I ate, and two of his guys had to bring me to the hospital there.
Oh, no.
But I got better. They brought me back to my hotel. I flew back to Florida. And I was going back to New York because Walter wanted me to run the operation in the five boroughs because he had different deals with automobile dealers, and they were all paying different prices for the product, which was upsetting one dealer after another. So I was with the gal that became my second wife, and it took 2 weeks to drive back. When I got back, a friend called me, tell me, where the hell you been? Because every day I would call my office and check her messages. And my secretary say, somebody calls every day, every morning. They ask for you. When I ask them who's calling, they will not give me a name, and they hang up. Found out that was Sonny.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. So anyways, Frank Russo and I had to go to New York. And as it turned out, it was Sonny's son, Michael Franchese. Had to do with a particular situation that took place in Long Island. It's all in my book, The Accidental Gangster, which is now available on Amazon.
Oh, good.
Okay, so it's up there now. Just went up a couple of days ago. So people can go there, and if they want an autographed copy, then go to my website, www.theaccidentalgangster.com.
Yeah.
Purchase a autographed copy.
Awesome.
All right. So I would appreciate your viewers. Check it out.
Yeah. All my listeners, please go to theaccidentalgangster.com and pick up your signed copy.
So we had a meeting at the Russian Tea Room. I sat directly in the booth across from Sonny. It was before it was open, and nobody else was in the restaurant at the time. Michael was sitting next to Sonny, Walter Fison next to me, Frank Russo and Lou Perry with chairs in the aisle. We had the meeting, and I didn't think Sonny was understanding it. So I tried to relate to Sonny. He said, let me explain it in terms you might understand. And I said, let's suppose somebody moves into your territory in the Bronx. And he looks at me with a cold. I thought I was dead.
No.
Johnny had the eyes that could kill you.
No.
Yeah, so he says, keep your mouth shut. Don't think for one moment I don't know what's happening. And I kept my mouth shut.
Yeah.
And the meeting turned out very well in our benefit. And after the meeting, we all walked out. We were on the street in front of the Russian Tea Room. Sonny grabbed me by the arm. He says, come on, kid, I want to talk with you. We walked to the corner of Broadway and 57. He says, you got balls, kid. I like you. From now on, he says, you use my name wherever you need to. He says, you're with me. And he says, I want you and your family in my home for Christmas. Christmas.
That's so sweet.
And we became friends for over 40 years until his death this year, at the age of 103.
Oh, my goodness.
And he was in a nursing home in Queens, and we were talking right up until his death.
Mm. Now, you wrote a letter to him, didn't you?
Yes, I did.
Would you like to read it?
Okay. Let's see, where do I put it? I'm sorry.
You're good.
All right. In my new book, my new revised edition, which is available right now for anybody to purchase, there's something that my publisher said, why don't you write letters to your friend? I never heard of anybody doing that.
Yeah.
I thought about it. I said, it's not a bad idea. Besides the letter here that I'm going to read to you about Sonny, that I wrote to Sonny, there's a letter to Michael, his son. There's letters to my mate Joey Pye, who passed away in London. And there's also other letters to other people.
I can't wait to read it.
I'm not going to tell you who they all are.
Yeah.
All right. This was dated July 19, 2020. Dear Sonny, I remember the first time we met at Eugene's restaurant on 2nd Avenue when Lou Perry introduced us. You had your wife, Christina, Gia, Johnny, and Tina. You and I whispered, and I explained the situation to you. And then we ate dinner. And I was allergic to the fish and got sick. No one ever forgot that. Nobody ever forgot that. Then our next meet was at the Russian Tea Room on 57th Street. I had to sit down, and I felt you were not understanding the problem, so I tried explaining in different terms, and you stared right through me as I keep your mouth shut. You did not have to say it twice, as I understood immediately. But it was after that meeting outside, as we were all standing, you grabbed my arm, walked me to the corner of 57th and Broadway and said, kid, you got balls. From now on, you're with me, and I want you and your family in my home for Christmas. From then on, we became friends, and I believe that was 1979, and we've been friends ever since. However, you got violated quite often, and we stay in touch through letter and telephone. It seems every time you came home, I was in New York. And then I moved to Little Neck, and we met every day for breakfast. And on Fridays, we met at the Douglas Manor for dinner with everyone. After that, I moved to Los Angeles, but we always stayed in touch. I came back to New York on a monthly basis, and it was you and me eating breakfast at diners and lunch and dinner at so many restaurants throughout the five boroughs, I cannot begin to count. That's in one day. I tell you, Sonny was able to eat. It was you who taught me many things. It was you who taught me that we are always for the underdog. And to this day, I still am, and I believe in it. Thank you. Then you began staying with me at my suite at the Warwick. I will never forget all those conversations we had in the maid's closet because we didn't trust the room, thinking it was bugged. More than likely, it was. Then finally, we all got indicted and we were at NBC together. And when we were in the discovery room, we had arguments, as you seriously believed that your son Johnny would not testify. But he did. The last time we physically saw each other was in the courtroom. Remember that conversation? Because we worked the bad situation out right there until the judge stopped us from talking. People ask me often, how can I like someone who did that? And my answer is always because we are real men, and real men work out their differences. I did my time, and of course you did your time. And once you were in the nursing home, we spoke on the phone a couple of times a week. I seriously wanted to come to see you. I contacted your PO. They declined me because I did not want to get you violated because of me. She told me I could visit you in June, but you left us before that. Our last conversation was maybe a little over a week before you passed on. My dear friend, you are now in peace, finally, after 103 years. You always had my love and respect, and that will never change. You were a friend and a real man amongst real men in a man's world. I miss you, and once again, all my love and respect to you, Sonny. Your friend always, Corey.
That's so sweet.
I could have written a 100-page letter to him.
I know. And I know, you know, since then you've extended an olive branch out to his son, Michael. But there was a time where he was kind of talking bad about you and saying you didn't know his dad and all this. And what did you feel about that at the time?
Honestly, you know what? You know, Michael's been doing interviews and podcasts and stuff for 30 years. I know Michael. I know things that Sonny has said to me about Michael. I know the people who were around Michael. I don't have, you know, we had a feud. It was a big feud. It could have gotten serious. But there was nothing for neither one of us to gain from it.
Yeah.
And, you know, what Michael did, he did. He did it. Everybody knows it. And, you know, somebody, a dear friend of mine said, you should watch this, these interviews, this Sammy Gravano's doing Michael Franks. Hey, maybe you can learn something. I said, I'm not in competition with these guys. They said, what are you talking about? I said, first of all, remember something. I did not ever inform on anybody. And what I say is the truth.
Yeah.
And people like me because I tell them the truth. I'm not going to lie to anybody because then you got to remember a lie. Why do you got to bog yourself down with that?
Yeah.
But, you know, that's all the work of our government and how they train and how they teach and inform us what to do. But anyways, I made a declaration and I did it, a video, and I ended the feud with Michael. We had a not conversations, but we texted each other on Facebook. And I don't listen to his podcast. And I doubt he listens to mine. I mean, there's other things we got to do.
Right, right. So what do you say to people that actually think you were an informant? Because there's a snippet on YouTube that has you on the phone with an agent.
I'm glad you asked that question. Okay. Long, long time ago, Jerry Zimmerman, who was with Michael before he was with me, was very close to Michael. Jerry had a warehouse. Jerry and I made a lot of money together. And I went out to his warehouse one day to see him, and there's this kid sitting in his waiting room. But Jerry came right out, grabbed me by the arm, and took me in the back of the warehouse. He said, see that kid? He said, don't do nothing with that kid. He wants to meet you. Don't do a thing with him. He said, that kid's been an informant since he's 15 years old.
Holy shit.
And he's a little Japanese kid. He's not Italian.
Yeah.
You know, he, His real name is Kaneko, Kenny Kaneko. And Jerry said, look, once in a while the kid brings me a porn video, I'm able to sell it because Jerry knew everybody in the porn industry, and like I did. And so I had nothing to do with him. It might have been maybe 2 weeks later. Now, Jimmy Cacci, who was the underboss here in Los Angeles, he and I were close friends. And Jimmy was the boss of Palm Springs, California. But on Monday mornings, Jimmy would come and he'd stay with me during the week and he and I do our business. But every morning, first thing, Jimmy and I were both up early. I guess it's a habit from prison. I don't know. And we would go to a place on Cannon Drive called Walters for breakfast. I mean, we're there. It's 7:30, 8 o'clock in the morning. Kenji Kaneko Gallo, he lived in Orange County. He comes walking in one morning. Sits right down at our table. He says, I happen to be in the neighborhood. You just happen to be in the neighborhood? And he knew everything about Jimmy from when he was born. He knew everything about me. I mean, he knew shit about me that I forgot. Where do you get that information from?
Yeah.
The FBI. But Jimmy reversed the situation and started taking money from him. First time, Jimmy got $3,500 from him. And Jimmy wanted to come give me some money. I said, Jimmy, I don't want none of it. You keep it. I told you, Jimmy, I want nothing to do with that kid. I never had nothing to do with him.
Yeah.
But when the FBI tried to turn me, for me, they wanted me to become an informant because I really knew some guys.
Yeah.
And I turned it down. One FBI agent got demoted off the Los Angeles FBI Organized Crime Task Force because of me. And it's in my book. I lived a dangerous life when I think what I do. But I went on record. I was taping the FBI. And I went on record with the boss in Buffalo, Joe Todaro, of what I was doing because Sonny was in prison. And, of course, when I got out of prison, Sonny called me and asked me what this is. I had to fly back to New York. And I explained to him, said, call Joe Todaro, which he did. You know, you mean you got to check those things out when somebody says something like that about you. You know, the thing is, nobody listens to that video that's up there.
I know. You didn't say a word.
They look at what he wrote. If they listen to it, you see I'm the one doing the taping.
Yeah.
I'm the one recording that agent. I had 12 tapes. 12 tapes. So now you understand why the FBI agent got demoted.
Yeah.
And Kenji Gallo, and then he got involved with the Columbus back in New York, picked up one kid that was getting out of prison in a limousine with girls from the porn business, and as a gift, he gave him a cell phone. Of course, it was bugged.
Ooh.
And he brought down other guys. They tried bringing me down in a large case in Las Vegas. Because Jimmy wanted me to listen to him and two other people about a deal of laundering some money. And we met over at the Beverly Grove over here. We walked out. I looked at Jimmy and I said, Jimmy, I know you've been friends with Abe for a long time. I said, I told you I would never do anything with that kid Kenny. I don't trust him. I said, no, the other guy there, neither you or I know who he is, and you're taking Abe's word on who that guy is. I said, I want nothing to do with this, Jimmy. I advise you not to do anything with them. And they eventually did that there, and I had no part of it. And then there was a murder in Las Vegas. Herbie Blitzstein, who was with Tony Spilotro, was murdered. And it became a big indictment. Jimmy got indicted on that there, and Jimmy's brother, a bunch of other people. And Kenny was an informant on that case.
Yeah. Well, that's a dangerous situation to be an informant. I mean, did anybody want to whack him and get him out of the way? I mean, it seems like it wasn't really a huge secret that he was an informant.
There was no huge secret, but you know, the world has changed since the movie The Godfather. The movie The Godfather was a ruination of the secret society. Up until then, we were a secret society. What happened in the shadows stayed in the shadows. Of course, people on the street know who we are. But, you know, you got to remember, we were formulated to help our own. And we still believe in that theory, to help our own. But, you know, nowadays, the FBI and all law enforcement, they know more about us. I mean, I just read it a couple of weeks ago where some people were getting sworn in Philadelphia. The whole thing was recorded because there was an informant in there. Now, if you go back to the 50s, the 40s, the 50s, the 60s, any of this stuff happened, those people would not be talking. Yeah. It would have been quietly dealt with and nobody be talking about it. Today, they all got podcasts. So, you know, it is what it is. We live in a changing world.
Yeah. Well, did Sonny actually put a hit out on you? Like, what was the deal with that?
He approved the hit on me. There was an informant who was the biggest informant in our case. His name was Guy Fattaro. You know, I always had a saying, show me the biggest, toughest guy, I'm going to show you an informant. You know, the guys who brag how tough they are, those are the guys who are going to become informants. You sure shit, I was right here. But Sonny thought that Guy and I could make some money, sent him up to California. And it happened to be at the same time a Jamaican boy that was with me named Ricky Lee was arrested for shipping drugs to North Carolina. He was in downtown Los Angeles waiting to be extradited to North Carolina. He had $500,000 on the streets in Brooklyn. His wife came with two Mexicans that he owed the money to. And for me to get the money. I knew the guys on the streets, and I called them up. They said, Ori, we got $100,000 ready right now. We're going to pay this, Ori. But Ricky didn't understand that, you know, it was cocaine.
Yeah.
He thought we were just buying the kilos and going to sell them as kilos. He said, it's being converted to crack, so it's taking longer. We had the first $100,000 picked up, and I never saw another nickel because Fattaro said, oh, I'll have somebody pick it up right now. Yeah, he did.
Oh, my God.
And he sent me some of that money, I'll be honest. But they collected the rest, and I never got a nickel, and my people never got a nickel. But what Fattaro did with the Mexicans, he said, we're going to get your money for you. But you got to give us 50 kilos every 2 weeks. I got the way to transport it back to New York. We'll make a lot of money. And now he put my name. I said, I don't do cocaine. I've never been involved in cocaine. And, you know, not in that capacity. I've seen cocaine, trust me.
Yeah.
You know, but kilos?
Yeah.
And so now he goes back to New York and he speaks to the acting captain. And he's telling the acting cat that all the money he's going to make with Ori. Now, you got to remember, every one of these things is recorded. So he's telling the captain how much money that everybody's going to make with his big cocaine deal with Ori. Ori. The deal ain't going to happen. First of all, these guys haven't gotten back their other half a million. They ain't going to put 1 kilo on until they're paid. Okay?
Yeah.
That's pure common sense. I mean, these guys are not stupid.
Right.
Not good money to chase bad money. So, and he keeps telling Michael this. And then Michael keeps asking him about it. Now, Michael and I never had a conversation about it. Not one word about it. And then the informant tells, I think Ori's fucking us out of the money here. All right? Ori's doing the deal and he's keeping all the money. Now that pisses the captain off. He goes to Sonny, who was his uncle, and gets permission to whack me.
Damn.
And that's what Sonny and I took care of when we had the discussion in the courtroom. Because he came in, Sonny was on a bail. I wasn't. I couldn't get bail. And Sonny and I resolved it. But, you know, he said, "You're upset with me, buddy." I said, "Let me explain why." I said, "You used to call me to come in for fucking dinner. All right, I used to get on a plane. Anytime you asked me to, I got on a plane and flew back." I said, "You didn't call me and ask me what the hell's really going on here? If you would have, you would have found out the guy Furtado's an informant."
Good Lord.
So that's what happened.
So what charges did they actually get you on?
They got me on cocaine distribution. Me and Michael Carapano were the only two people who never discussed a word between us. We got charged with distribution of cocaine. Okay?
Yeah.
The other one was a home invasion robbery out here in Burbank. And those were the main charges against me.
You're robbing houses, Ori?
Huh?
You're robbing houses?
I wasn't. Not a house. It was a safe, supposedly with $1 million. It was a set-up robbery.
Oh, shoot.
It's not that we pick the house and go rob it. We don't do that.
Yeah.
I was asked. But I had to make it look real.
Dang. What do you look back on and you're like, I can't believe that I actually lived through that, like a dangerous situation where you could have really messed up, but you made it.
You know, you got to understand, being in a life and how I grew up and everything, it's just so natural. You got to remember, I'm a guy that even today, when I walk down the street, I know what's behind every tree, behind every car. I walk in a restaurant, I know who's sitting where. I mean, I could look, I can glance around, I get their faces, and it locks into me. And then if there's a change, I recognize it immediately. This happens with a lot of us. I mean, this our life, you know. And if you hear, I'm doing a new. I'm going to do a weekly show, and I posted the first one on my YouTube. A Day in the Life.
Yes, I think that's what I shared on my Facebook yesterday.
Yeah,
I really loved your message in that.
And I got one, and I want to try to teach these young people who think being a gangster or in a gang and in a life They think it's glamorous. It's not glamorous. It's only glamorous when you watch these movies written by script writers.
Yeah, and they love that. They look up to that. And
they look up to that. And once they're in it, they know it ain't like that.
Yeah.
Yeah, the fast money, the fast woman, the fast cars, that's all good. But it don't last. So I recommend anybody's thinking about, wants to be in it or is in it, get out of it. Start a business, get a legitimate job, because at the end of the day, you're going to have more money than you ever would have.
Yeah, and you're risking your life every day.
Otherwise, you're risking your life or you're going to go to prison. That's the only two things that are going to happen to you.
Yeah.
Don't think that the FBI is stupid. They're highly intelligent. They're all college graduates. And just the FBI alone, there's over 38,000 employees.
Good Lord.
Throughout the country and the world. Okay. Not including the DEA and all the other government agencies, okay? They got the equipment, they got the money, and they got the time.
Yeah. Yeah.
Everything you don't have, they got. So it's just going to be a matter of time that they will get a knock at the door, and it's not, it's a loud knock, trust me.
Yeah.
Open up the door.
Oh, yeah, because, I mean, you're really just waiting for that knock if you're in that life, because yeah, it's going to come.
It's going to happen. I'll never forget the day I got arrested. I'm sitting in my chair, 5:45 in the morning. I got the news on. My dog's in my lap. Got my cigarette, my coffee. And I heard car doors opening, shut. No, you don't hear nothing on my street at that hour of the morning.
Oof.
Okay? And I just knew it. I knew it. And sure as shit.
Damn.
Knock on the door. Open that door. I'll never forget. And I had a cigarette in my hand. The agent knocked the cigarette out of my hand. And that was my last cigarette for 62 months.
Damn. Oh. Well, how did you become so well known with Hollywood elites? And how did they know to come to you?
Once again, it's just something that, you know, things happen and it was an accident. I was very close with Dino De Laurentiis and Ralph Serpy. Dino and Carlo Ponti and Ralph, they had the film studios in Italy, and they came to this country. And I became close with them through Frank Russo again.
Yeah.
And, you know, I get a call one day, asked me to see me, and they tell me about a situation. I said, I'll take care of it. And, you know, I have a certain ability, and I... People ask me what I have. It's probably come from my... First of all, you know, I'm not a dummy. And I'm well-read. I read every single day. And I read a book every night. Not the whole book, but I read every night.
Yeah.
And I got the ability to talk and understand. And I got the ability to make other people understand of how and why they should do the right thing. I can do it all without a gun. Never needed a gun.
Yeah. I can tell you've always been the kind of person that people can talk to and feel comfortable talking to.
Yeah, I should have named my book The Accessible Gangster.
I love that. So... there was a situation where Wyclef Jean had to come to you. Do you want to talk a little bit about why Wyclef came to you?
Well Wyclef, he and I became friends through Danny Sims, who was the guy who discovered Bob Marley. And one day he called me up. He was a close friend of Naomi Campbell. He was concerned about a stalker that she told him about. Asked me if I would talk with Naomi. Around Christmas time, I met with her at her home. She explained the problem. She didn't have the kid's address, so I had to find out where it was, which we had the ability to do those things. And found out he lived out in Long Island. So I had two guys go and visit him. And my instructions were to put them on the phone with me when they got there. And once again, I spoke to him in the manner to convince him that he better not even think of Naomi ever again.
Did you threaten him?
I didn't say I threatened him. I talked to him nicely.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, were you and Suge Knight always just knowing each other, or how did y'all meet?
Another accident. I had an overstock from Universal on thousands of DVDs. I was able to make some money with them. And I had a buyer out of London. His name was Ron Winters. Ron was in the music. He wanted to buy them to distribute them. So we made a deal, and he was to wire me the money. Ron could tell you and drag you on for months, swearing he wired the money, but he never did. Well, yeah, when I came to the reality of it, I was really pissed. I knew that he came into town, but when he'd come into town, he'd check into a hotel. You could not just call and ask for Ron Winter. They would say he's not here, right? Not registered.
Yeah.
But a producer friend of mine had a meeting with him at the Beverly Wilshire Hotel, and he told me about it. I said, I'm going to be there. Give me his room number. I think he was up on the 11th floor, too, if I remember correctly, which was good because I was going to throw him out the window. But he had a meeting with Suge Knight. So Suge's there, and the producer tells Suge that I'm downstairs and what I was going to do. Well, he owed Suge a lot of money. Suge came down. I was at the bar waiting for the call to go upstairs. Suge comes down. We then introduces himself, and he asked me if I would not do anything. He said, I promise you we'll make money somewhere else. Okay? Yeah. So for Suge, I did it. And then the day came that Suge called me. He happened to be the same guy that owed Suge Knight a few million dollars. Well, my friends, me, and yes, Suge asked me to get it. And my friends in London, I called my friends in London, Joey Pyle, and we got the money. We got the first million. And it was wired to Suge. It was really wired. Yeah. He didn't push it on that one. But Suge had been violated, was in prison. But from prison, he called his lawyer. The lawyer made the money, and the next day, I had my commission, of which I split with my friends in London. Just like that. And from that day on, Suge and I became friends. I mean, we had a mutual respect for each other.
Yeah.
I found Suge to be a good guy. You know, I just wish, you know, it's like a lot of people. Sometimes people can't keep their mouth shut, you know, and because I don't believe that what they got him in prison for that he actually did.
Yeah.
I believe he was just trying to protect himself.
Yeah. Because you know him better than us out here speculating. You know, when you know somebody, you kind of, you know.
Right.
So, before we go, I do want to ask you, you know, what would you say to these kids that think, man, I want that life? I you know, what they see on Scarface or Goodfellas or, you know, all these gangster movies, and they think, man, I want the money, the cars, the women, or, you know, women want to be like the Black Widow or, you know, something like that. What would you say?
Don't. Understand that movies, film writers write for everybody. It's got to be a movie that's going to air in the Midwest and the people are going to love it. You know, people bring me scripts and the first question, all right, will the people in the Midwest like it? Okay?
Really?
Because those are the people. All right? That's just a saying out here in Hollywood. Okay? A script writer, they take my book. I can guarantee you somebody's going to be doing my story. All right, he's a famous writer, director. I cannot disclose his name as of this time.
Yeah.
He's done several movies. You've seen him. Some movies with Robert De Niro and Morgan Freeman, Tommy Lee Jones.
Big nice.
Actor. He wants to write my story. So it's going to happen. I can't tell you when everything shut down here.
Yeah. But, well, who would you pick to play you? If you could.
You know, originally going way back when I first began writing the book, people asked me that question. My answer was Tom Hardy.
Yeah.
But, you know, he done Capone, which did not do well. It was a terrible movie. My belief, how they're going to, you know what? One thing I learned as a gangster, somebody wants to write my story, let them write it. I'm interested in the payday that I will receive, okay? And I don't know how it's going to be written, what they're going to put in there that's not in the book, you know?
Yeah.
But you could rush your shirt. There's going to be a lot that's not in the book that'll be in the movie. Because right. They're going to have to make things up. There's no killings in my book, but there might be a killing in the movie. All right, because people love that.
Yeah.
All right. My hopes were that it would be a younger actor, and that with a young cast and crew in the movie and showing me and depicting me as a younger man here in Hollywood.
And then growing up, they would maybe get a different actor.
How things developed with me in Hollywood. I gotta remember, I got over 40 years here.
Yeah.
So, but, you know, I leave that up to the writers and the people. And I'll only talk when they ask me a question.
Yeah.
I'm not going to tell them how to do it. It's not my business.
Yeah. I sure can't wait to
telling them how to do their job. You ain't gonna get nothing done.
Yeah, that's true. I sure cannot wait to. I'm gonna order your book today, and when they start working on the movie, it's gonna be so exciting. I can't wait.
It will be.
Well, I hope that everybody goes to your website, theaccidentalgangster.com, and picks up a signed copy of your book. I love talking to you. You are just the best. We'll definitely have to keep in touch. And
absolutely. You know, if you want to do this again sometime, let me know.
Yeah, okay. For sure. All right.
Let me know how it does for you. I hope it increases your ratings also.
Yeah.
Because it's a two-part thing here.
Yeah.
And everybody's got a win for them.
Yeah. I so appreciate you. You know, yeah. I really want some, I hope some younger people listen and realize, like, maybe this isn't what I want, you know?
Well, look, I have a Gmail account, theaccidentalgangster@gmail.com. Any young man out there, is thinking of it, wants to do it, thinks it's glamorous, send me an email. And I'll get back to you, I promise. All right, and I might ask you for your phone number, and I might give you a call.
Yeah.
Okay, but if I get
home, you're the fixer, so you can. I think you can fix it.
All right, keep watching my videos every Sunday. It'll be coming out, and there's a purpose. I'm going to be telling people another story. Okay, when I say the FBI have time and money. In 1997, that FBI agent said, I will see the day you are chained, shackled, put on Con Air, and brought to Brooklyn. 1997, 2008, he made that a reality. So don't think you're going to get away with anything, folks. Young man, so write me at the Accidental Gangster. A Gmail. If I could help you, I definitely will be there for you. And go to my website. You can purchase an autographed book, or just go to Amazon. You can buy the book directly from there. I thank you all. It was a pleasure, Paige. God bless you.
God bless you, Ori. I love you.
Take care, honey.
All right, you too. Bye. All right.
Okay, over here we go. I think it went well, Paige. I like your questions.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. Right. We'll keep in touch for sure.
All right, honey. Bye-bye.
All right. Bye.
Hi, I'm Taylor.
Hi, I'm Jenny.
Are you into ghosts, aliens, or murder? It's okay if you do, because we love terrible things, too.
It's why we started our podcast, A Little Bit Grim.
We talk about the paranormal,
true crime,
folklore,
cults,
conspiracies,
some disasters,
and every other heinous thing that could possibly happen to a person.
It's a little bit spooky.
It's a little bit funny.
And it's a little bit grim.
And you can find us wherever you like to stream your podcasts.
And find us on your favorite social media platforms.
We'll see you there. Goodbye!